To call our last case for today in on the January calendar, 06 AP 882 CR, State versus Harris. Counsel for Mr. Harris, how do you pronounce your name?
Sigalski.
I'm glad you told me about Ralph. Okay, good. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. It's great to be here in Madison. It's kind of crazy up in Packer country because they have the new Packer ordinance, which requires that if 20 or more people gather, you have to have a five-minute impromptu pep rally. I think we're a little short in the room today, but
we do the same.
Nevertheless, we can do it.
We do the same thing here.
I actually put on a green shirt this morning, and I didn't want to confuse anybody. So.
And why do we have that rally?
How?
Why?
We'll talk to you later.
Okay. They'll explain it to me later. Okay. Good.
I'm sure that during plea dates up in Green Bay, it is a problem. 20 new people show up. And so, I'm here representing Ronell Harris in this particular case. He was convicted, obviously, of possession of cocaine with intent to deliver out of Sheboygan County Court. There are four issues that are up for appeal. Very briefly, the fingerprint issue, the pants issue, the Chicago bail bond issue, and the cumulative effect of all three of those as a separate issue. I think that is quite obvious that the most important issue is the fingerprint issue. And the late disclosure of the negative inference or the negative potential testing of that fingerprint test result. Looking at this case and doing further research in preparation for oral argument, not only am I seeing many missed opportunities in the briefing that I did, but I also found a great many quotes that are applicable to some of the gaps in regard to the potential arguments that were made. The two cases that I have focused on most, of course, have similar names, State versus DeLeo and State versus Del Real. The DeLeo case, obviously, is longer, more detailed. Del Real is a shorter case with a very quick and precise holding. But the DeLeo case, with all of its detail, does provide, especially on page 318, paragraphs 63, 64, and 65, some of the sentiments that I think need to be discussed and considered in regard to what we are doing here today. It talks about pretrial discovery and that one of the purposes of it is so that defense counsel can rely upon evidence as disclosed by the state. Otherwise, the purpose of discovery is frustrated and more injustice is done than if no discovery were allowed. And that is DeLeo. It's also quoting the Wold, W-O-L-D, case. Now, I think that that particular situation is applicable, and I think it was anticipated in regard to what occurred over in Sheboygan in this case. Mr. Gary shows up about 8:20 in the morning. He is confronted by Assistant District Attorney O'Rourke and is told that, oh, I've got this other report. Here it is. And part of that report, which is Exhibit 7 at trial, says that Mr. Ronell Harris was confronted about the question of if his fingerprints would appear on the cocaine. I believe some more information must have come out somewhere along the way, off the record, because it is discussed in that morning conference in chambers with Judge Bork about some actual visual surveillance or visual testing that was done. Over the noon hour, after opening statements and I believe some testimony having been taken, then another report comes out, which is dated approximately 2 months later, stating that they tried to do indeed some in-house testing at the law enforcement agency in Sheboygan, and that is Exhibit 8 from the trial record that says that they were unable to lift any fingerprints. It was a negative test. Now, I think clearly that this is exculpatory evidence. Under 971.23, and there would be Parent 1, Parent H, I believe this is also Exhibit 7 anyway, as 971.23, Parent 1, Parent B, written summary of oral statements by the defendant, as well as under sub E, a relevant written or recorded statement of a witness. I think both of these fit. I don't think there's a huge issue, really, in regard to whether or not this was discoverable. It clearly was. I think Judge Bork agreed. I don't think that there is a serious argument that can be made that this could properly be withheld. And I think what we can also discuss with that is the not really the strategy, but what really occurs in regard to these cases at the circuit court level, at least where I'm practicing in northeast Wisconsin, is a complete open book, open file type of procedure in the district attorney's offices. Come on, take a look at the file if you want. We're not hiding anything. Make copies of everything as it comes in. perhaps there are prosecutors out there with the time to really go through discovery and say, well, this is discoverable, that isn't, I'm going to hold on to this, or maybe hold it to the last minute if it becomes relevant on rebuttal or something. But I don't see that happening. And I think when Mr. Gary was so upset and so frustrated that what really occurred here was that he was relying upon the prosecution to have that open file policy. If we have it, you'll get it. We're not going to make any distinctions. And that also gets to the DeLeo case, that the purposes of the criminal discovery are to ensure fair trials and encourage the entering of pleas if necessary, and that's quoting the Irby, I-R-B-Y case, and that the state or that the a defendant must have the opportunity to choose a strategy and prepare for trial in light of all the evidence that should have been provided. And I think that that is exactly what did not occur here. This also, I think, ties in with Del Rio, which is that you should be able to predict what occurs at trial and rely completely upon what has already been disclosed.
Mr. Sigalski, my understanding is that there was a request of the trial court for an instruction in regard to the fingerprint evidence. What happened in regard to that request?
The judge really did not give an instruction. Basically apologized to the jury, sorry for the delay, objections are proper. I think some comment to the effect of don't make an inference about either side in that regard. Now let's move forward.
So he did sort of give an instruction, but it wasn't a very direct one. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, that'd be a very fair. I mean, there is. It's part of the sanctions of 971.23, parent 7M, I believe it's B, that talks about giving an instruction, really in lieu of the other mandatory sanction, which is not to allow the evidence in. But it raises a good point, that this is really kind of an unusual twist on the case. I mean, normally speaking, if I'm the criminal defense lawyer, which I've been in many, many cases, something exculpatory comes in, I'm jumping for joy. I like that. Mr. Gary really didn't want that in this particular case because he really had a twofold defense, which was circumstantial evidence in this case is unreliable. There's a whole bunch of other drug dealers in this house. This is all circumstantial, nothing direct. Don't blame Ronell Harris for this. And number two, if they really wanted to get Ronell Harris, doggone it, they could have done more. They could have done the fingerprinting. Maybe they could have taken some more statements. They could have done who knows what else, other scientific testing. And that wasn't done. And that was really his strategy going in. And just looking through that transcript, the frustration that Mr. Gary felt is palpable. You just can see it flying off the page. And I think that, you know, if there had been that sanction of the instruction from Judge Bork, perhaps we wouldn't be here today. Perhaps there would have been a different result at trial. But certainly the statute would have been addressed. One amazing thing regarding this whole case in the trial transcript is that I don't see anything anywhere where Section 971.23 was addressed. Maybe I missed it. I've read the transcript several times, but I did not see that. That's not unusual, I guess. Sometimes you get a very thorough judge who will go and grab the books, make sure that, you know, the proper statutory or case law procedures are being used. In this case, there's a jury waiting. Let's get this going. This is one document. Is it really all that bad? Okay, let's go on out there. And unfortunately, 971.23 was just simply not addressed, in my opinion.
Was the request of defense counsel specific in terms of what was desired as far as an instruction?
Yes, I believe I included that in my appendix, if I may.
Sure.
One of the first things, I think, it's page 104 of the appendix. It talks about exculpatory evidence under paragraph 11. It specifically cites the Giglio case, the Ruiz case, Stanislavski. Before that, on page 103 of my appendix, it talks about written and oral statements of the defendant. And number six under that is any and all relevant written or recorded statements of a witness. So those things are specifically in there.
You're talking about what's in the demand for discovery and inspection.
Correct, I am.
I think Justice Crook's question went to what was in the request for the instruction to the jury.
Oh,
exactly. I was asking specifically what did defense counsel ask for. Thank you, Justice Butler.
Thank you for clarifying that. Sorry. It's in the transcript. I believe that it is quoted in the brief itself. I believe that section of the transcript is in there. It is a relatively lengthy appendix. But it was one of those things that even Judge Bork mentions this to Attorney Gary, saying you're arguing three things at the same time. It is a little bit confused, but I think he does come out and say, Judge, I want a strong instruction, an admonishment to the jury. And the judge replies, well, I'll give, I can't remember if he said vanilla or something to that effect, or, you know, one that doesn't really pin the blame one way or the other. And I think that Attorney Gary certainly wanted more than that. I think it's the transcript makes that relatively clear. So really, in regard to the fingerprint issue, I think that there are essentially four questions that we have to address. And number one is, was it discoverable in the first place? Number two, was the day of trial sufficient notice for any of these? Number three, was there good cause for the tardy disclosure? And number four, what was the proper sanction? I think we've kind of jumped to the end with the proper sanction, and that's fine, because I was planning potentially to do that anyway in my argument. If you go to the proper sanction issue, which I'll dwell on a little bit here, was what was the defendant's strategy, I think, becomes important. Because if your strategy, for example, is you've got the wrong guy, and perhaps it's part of it too, but the defense strategy in this particular case was lack of evidence mixed in, of course, with that shoddy investigation strategy that he was going to put forward. And I think then you get to whether or not there really was prejudice, and then what the proper sanction would be.
In looking at the proper sanction, it's my understanding that there was no request when this information came up for a continuance or recess. Is that correct?
It was couched in terms of a mistrial. And I realize there's a shade of a difference there, but Attorney Gary never did request a continuance or recess. That's correct. I wish he had. I think that it's a little other, I guess, linguistic stumbling block that we have. I mean, I guess practical matter, I guess I don't really know the difference between a mistrial and a continuance or recess other than, well, will we make the jury wait for another hour while you talk this over with your client? Will we come back another day? Whereas a mistrial, I suppose you could have a double jeopardy argument somewhere along the way if it's ultimately granted. I've never seen that happen.
I do think there is a distinction, and jeopardy is one of the reasons. Right. But the reason I ask the question is because when defense counsel is given this supposed new information, and I understand it occurred after the opening statement, is that correct?
The new information came up before. They picked the jury. There was all kinds of discussions in chambers.
Came after.
The report, I believe, came before. At 8:20 a.m., I believe the report was handed to Mr. Gary.
If I remember, well, I don't mean to argue the point, but as I recall, there was some discussion about some of the issue beforehand, but then there was a report that was gotten over the noon hour out of another file. I think the patent file maybe is the one that they came out of, that was the missing piece in terms of this. But the long and the short of it is, in the absence of a request for a continuance or recess, what I'm trying to focus on is what should be the appropriate sanction. And it seems to me if the concern is the strategic approach, and now my strategy is all up in the air, should the attorney have asked for more time to work out the strategy and then work on the appropriate language for any corrective instruction?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think if Mr. Gary had taken a few deep breaths and taken some time and maybe walked around the courthouse a little bit, maybe this all would have been clearer to him, but he wasn't given the luxury of that. I think, you know, if he had asked for 10 minutes, would Judge Bork have given him that? I know Judge Bork. He probably would have, okay? But Mr. Gary was obviously extremely flustered as a result of this. I mean, he even still mentions in his opening statement that the fingerprint testing was never done. There's no fingerprints here, something to that effect. And I'm pretty sure that Exhibit 7 was actually given to him ahead of time. But
I don't know if a continuance would have made any difference here. If your argument is that he had already embarked on a strategy, then a continuance wouldn't have helped him because he would have had to back off that strategy and try something else. But he'd already started.
Right. Well, continuance is an interesting way to put it. Recess implies, okay, we'll just take some time off and we'll come back in an hour or so. A continuance could mean we'll send the jury home, come back tomorrow, perhaps. I think, you know, how I would have handled it, don't know if anybody cares about that or even if that's relevant, but I think that I probably would have sat down with the prosecutor and said, okay, let's work this out, and a plea would have been entered, okay? But I don't think that there's any real constitutional issue.
Think there would have been a plea agreement to a lesser charge?
Oh, sure. I think that the prosecution was probably, on the defensive, you know, put it that way. I mean, they were the ones that somehow missed these reports, and I think that perhaps a good deal could have been struck.
Well, if you get to the issue of harmless error, one technique used for harmless error is that how overwhelming is the evidence in favor of the conviction. So tell us how strong was the evidence against your client?
Well, the evidence against him, I think, walking into the trial that day was very, very slight. They had the clothing match between the pants and the jacket that the drugs were found in. They had the identifiers in the room that tended to point that Mr. Harris had been here for a while and wasn't simply an overnight guest. And then they had his physical proximity to the drugs. And we must remember there were other arrests that came out of this particular execution of the search warrant. There's a Mr. Appleton and I believe a Ms. Farmer were also prosecuted as a result of the drugs that were found in this particular residence. That argument still comes out moderately well, I think, in the trial, is that, wait a minute, it's all circumstantial evidence. You've got a bunch of other drug users here. There's drugs all over the place.
Well, was he convicted of using or selling?
He was convicted of possession with intent to deliver.
Right. Go ahead.
So as far as the intent to deliver portion, I think all you really have is perhaps the quantity of the cocaine that was found to really get beyond just a possession case. But harmless error is an interesting issue, too. As I did more research, I looked at the Kyles case from the U.S. Supreme Court. It's that Louisiana case involving the parking lot where they checked to see if there were license plates that matched. And in that particular case, it says that you don't really get to harmless error, that materiality really gets to the prejudicial issue and you don't really deal with harmless error. In Wisconsin, I think harmless error is alive and well, but I guess, you know, it's an interesting scholarly point to make, but I think harmless error is still something that obviously has to be addressed. This was a really, really minor issue, obviously.
What's minor?
Minor issue would have been perhaps that instead of weighing the cocaine without the baggie or taking that into account, they weighed it with the weight of the baggie there as well, for example, and maybe it's a slightly different grammage. That would be, I think, harmless error. If you're talking, I don't even know what the weight is here, but instead of 73.9 grams, now you have, if you take away the baggie, 72.3 grams. That's harmless error. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Harmless error could be that I imagine the jacket was hanging on the bedpost where he was found that morning as opposed to laying at the foot of the bed.
Okay, well, he's in with a group of people who are either using or dealing drugs. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, and that was brought out at trial.
Correct.
All right. His puts on a pair of pants, and do the pants have his identification, or is it the jacket?
I don't think either of them really had identification. I could be wrong there, but there was a match. There were kind of an unusual green.
One of them had, what, the bail?
The bail bond, yes, was found. It might have been in a pocket in one or the other.
But I think the other one had his wallet or identification. Okay,
right.
So he's staying there for some time. The jacket, which matches the pants that he selected, has the bail bond. Where are the drugs found?
The drugs, I believe, are in a pocket in the jacket.
The drugs are in the pocket in the jacket, so it looks like it's his jacket, right?
Correct.
The other guy that shared that room in which the jacket hung hasn't been there for a while, right?
There are other people in and out, correct. I don't know the detail in that particular light, but yes.
So that's all the evidence against your client?
Pretty much. That's it. And the bail bond evidence, of course, it came out that it was a criminal mm-hmm. bond. The jury heard that.
What was that for? Didn't it show?
It was an inadvertent mistake, as you recall. But it showed it was a criminal bond with his name.
Did they say why he was on, why he had this document?
I don't believe so.
Was it for another drug case?
Nobody ever found out.
Okay, that's all. All right. Okay. So you view that as just slight. The state presents this as overwhelming evidence of guilt.
Right.
So you say slight evidence of guilt, and at the same time, your strategy has been knocked out by the failure to give the fingerprint.
Right.
How important is the pants evidence?
And the pants in all of this? According to Timothy Gary, it was very important. I guess they were kind of an unusual, I don't know, designer jogging suit or something of that nature, an unusual green color. So that became, the match became important to Mr. Gary. I know he testified to that at one point in one of the motions.
But the testimony about who selected the pants, how important is that?
Well, that came out, of course, and that's my second point in this entire case, was that he apparently took the pants, according to what Mr. Gary knew ahead of time before trial, but then during the testimony of one of the officers, he apparently said, could you hand me my pants, something to that nature. And so that really did show ownership of the pants being his. And Mr. Gary, of course, made objections in that regard, too.
And that tied it in with the jacket, and the jacket had the drugs.
Correct.
Okay. And the bail bond shouldn't have been admitted.
Well, the bail bond itself as an identifier, I think that that would be admitted, but to have the officer say, yeah, this is a criminal bail bond out of Chicago, that's the problem I have with it.
And you're saying this cumulative effect in a weak case should not have should entitle you to a new trial.
All three of those things, that's my fourth argument, but it's each one separately as well. Okay. So as far as, you know, the prejudice is concerned regarding the fingerprints, I think that there was a misunderstanding by Judge Bork, and maybe perhaps even at the Court of Appeals level, that the strategy of having exculpatory evidence in this case isn't say, yee-haw, I just got some exculpatory evidence. It's really, wait, the exculpatory evidence just shoots my strategy. Yes, sir? Justice Prosser, it looked like you were about to say, okay. So I guess...
Let me ask you about that. In terms of prejudice, as I understood the argument at trial, defense counsel was going to argue on the one hand, look, there's no evidence here to show that this is my client's. There's nothing to connect the fingerprint here. They didn't even look.
Correct.
And after discovering that they did look, what defense counsel is left with is there's nothing here to show that this is my client. They looked, and they couldn't match it.
Right.
How big is the difference?
According to Mr. Gary, it's very significant. If you look at the post-conviction motion, the second one where he explains that, he says, well, his strategy essentially remained the same, but it was significantly different. And then he goes on to explain that. What do you do with fingerprint evidence? If they don't ask for it, then you say shoddy investigation.
See, I guess the reason I asked the question is it seems to me that from a strategic standpoint of arguing that this is exculpatory, any damage that might have occurred during the trial really doesn't focus on the exculpatory nature. It really focuses more or less on the opening statement that was made by defense counsel and perhaps how the circuit court should have handled an explanation of the opening statement. Because if the concern of defense counsel is it looks like defense is not prepared, they don't know what the case is all about, oh my God, this is going to fall back on my client, that's one thing. But if the concern is, and I think this is what the circuit judge was focusing on, look, your argument is it's not my guy, your argument still is it's not my guy, then depending upon your focus, I think it makes a difference on whether or not there's any real harm.
Correct. I mean, there's many ways to try to prove or to disprove that this is my guy or to show that this is not my guy, as I'm sure the court is aware. One way you can do it, of course, is to simply say poor identification. This isn't the same guy in the room. You know, there's other ways of doing that. But in this particular case, it's not my guy. But if they really wanted to get my guy, doggone it, why didn't they do these other tests? Why didn't they fingerprint? Why didn't they do any other things? Of course, Mr. Gary tied it in saying, well, if they had tested, then they are essentially admitting that they have a weak case. But that, I think, is a very weak argument. That's kind of a secondary argument. I've never really seen that one get anywhere, to be honest, in front of a jury or even in an appellate case. So I guess another... Yes?
Now I'm going to formulate this question. You cite the Thiel case for the cumulative effect of ineffective assistance of counsel. You don't have any authority right on point, do you, that cumulative effect of errors at the trial should lead to a reversal.
No, my fourth argument really does rely, I believe, mostly on that. Like the Zbar case, I think, is one that I relied on for that point. I think, though, that if you look at the Kyles case again from the U.S. Supreme Court, it does talk about that a bit, that, you know, what is a cumulative effect? Because Kyles involved many potential errors in Louisiana in that particular case. I think they actually, it's one of the 4 points regarding materiality. And so it does all kind of tie together. Where you want to pin it down and categorize it, I think, is an interesting point, translating from federal to Wisconsin law. Would be a difficult thing. I'd like to move on very briefly, if we can, to the good cause issue. Was there good cause for the tardy disclosure? And looking through the case law, I find many examples of cases where there was not good cause, not sufficient good cause, but not a whole lot of cases where, okay, this is good cause. There are a few. Yes, Chief? Looks like you're about to ask.
You should try and wind up quickly, please.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't
see. No. To finish up your sentence.
Okay. At good cause, there just aren't a lot of cases. I believe in this case, the day of trial certainly is not good cause. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Murphy, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Ann Murphy representing the state. I think right off the bat, I'd like to respond a little bit to the appellant counsel's arguments, positions he's taken on why we're really here today. And really, looking at all three issues and then his fourth issue of cumulative effect, none of these three issues individually created a prejudice to Mr. Harris. The discovery violation, even if there was one, with a disclosure on the day of trial of a document that basically confirmed what Mr. Harris's attorney already planned to argue, that there were no fingerprints on this baggie of cocaine that were found in the jacket close to where Mr. Harris was located in the house during the search warrant, that didn't change that at all. The fact that Mr. Harris's attorney was surprised, was thrown off course, that's unfortunate. It did not rise to a level of prejudice that so undermines our confidence in the result of the verdict in this case that
Ms. Murphy,
it should warrant a mistrial.
Yes, isn't the real issue from defense counsel's perspective, I understand that they've argued it was a change in strategy, and arguably attorneys, as you know, have to be able to move quick on their feet because things shift in the middle of trial. But isn't the real concern here that after giving an opening statement based on the defense counsel's understanding of the evidence, defense counsel may now look like an idiot in front of the jury? Isn't that the concern? And does that have an impact on the jury verdict?
Your Honor, I think that was a concern of Attorney Geary. I think I hate to fault a trial attorney who is doing the best job he possibly can, but I think from my reading of the transcript, which I've done numerous times, that he was at fault for what happened in his opening statement, and here's why. The conference that occurred in the chambers prior to opening statements was where the prosecutor said, clearly, we checked the bag for fingerprints, I know that happened, and there was nothing that we could send for testing. And Attorney Geary responded with, well, that's a scientific test in and of itself. You should have revealed that to me. You should have turned that over. The trial judge agreed, yes, that should have been turned over, but what's the harm here? What's the difference? There's no fingerprints. We're right where we started. It's basically neutral. Then they went out, did opening statements. Attorney Geary still said no testing had been done in his opening statement. It was one small sentence in a fairly lengthy opening statement. Just based on that, I don't think it was that harmful to him, his reputation or his impression to the jury. But, you know, he did make that statement after he'd been told there was a check. And
wasn't
check
he told in chambers in that same conference by the assistant district attorney that prosecuted the case that there was no scientific testing done? I can attest to that, or I can assert that. So if defense counsel is going out and making an argument based on a representation that occurred in chambers that there was no testing done, and then lo and behold, over the noon hour, here's a test that shows up that says, we checked for these items. There was nothing discernible here. Well, now you've got an issue in front of the jury where, admittedly, the shift in strategy is one thing, but you've got a separate question of,
Here's defense counsel who has asserted that there's nothing here. Now we know it's here. Should that have been explained by the circuit court to the jury, some explanation given as to why this is now here when it wasn't here before, pursuant to 97123 sub 7?
Your Honor, I don't think that the circuit court was required in its discretion to admonish the jury or to place blame on the state for what had happened here. They had worked it out in chambers explaining to defense counsel, we tried to lift prints. I think there's an argument here that that's not a scientific test. And what they talked about in chambers was nothing was ever sent to the laboratory, that being what would be the scientific test. Any results of that obviously would be highly.
But wasn't the issue that the fact that there was a report that was discoverable that had been requested that had not been disclosed because apparently it was in another file that was then turned over? So that was the issue, as I understand it, that in terms of the discovery violation, that we had material here, we're aware of it, and in fact, as I understand it, the same prosecutor prosecuted both cases, but the report didn't come out until after the trial had begun. And so the question once again becomes under 97123 sub 7, did the circuit court, once that became known, and after defense counsel had, in reliance upon that, made an argument based on that, should the circuit court have given an instruction explaining what had occurred?
Your Honor, again, I don't think the circuit court was required. There's no mandatory provision for giving an instruction as to what occurred regarding a discovery violation. What the sanction section says is that evidence not presented for inspection or copying required by this section, unless good cause is shown for failure to comply, shall be excluded. Now, the court did that. The court said to the prosecutor, the state may not, on direct examination of Investigator Patton, may not discuss fingerprints, whether fingerprints were checked for, looked for, or anything like that. So they did not allow the exhibit, which was eventually became Exhibit 8 after the defense attorney brought it up on his cross-examination and thus opened the door to that testimony. But the trial court did sanction the state properly by saying you can't bring this up on direct. You know, the fact that the evidence was probably more favorable to the defendant, you know, that plays both ways, I guess. I mean, it maybe wasn't a harsh sanction on the state, but I don't think a harsh sanction was required in this case. It was inadvertent. There is absolutely no allegation anywhere in the record or in the briefs that this was prosecutorial misconduct, that there was any intent here, that there was any, you know, attempt to bury a document. I think both sides agree there's an open file policy. Everything should have been turned over. They thought going into that day that everything was turned over, and ADA O'Rourke had a memory from having done a plea hearing on one of the other defendants' cases there was some kind of memo I saw in the file. So he went back over the lunch hour and found that memo, which just confirmed what he had explained before trial started in chambers, that I know that they attempted to lift fingerprints, but none could be lifted that were able to be tested.
Let me ask you, is it your position that the prosecutor acted perfectly acceptable under a 971 is a 23. No error at all. Everything is just fine. Why are we here? Is that your position?
Your Honor, I would say that would be overstating my position a bit.
I
would say no trials
position
are without completely mistake-free. Error is maybe a stronger way to phrase it. I don't think this was error, at least in terms of the disclosure of the document and the statement issues.
The statute requires them to hand over certain things, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it says in a reasonable time, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And what we have here is the morning of the trial, right? And then at lunchtime.
Yes.
This prosecuted people who were in the same house for drugs.
I don't believe, I'm not positive of this, I don't believe those cases had gone to trial yet, it had been prosecuted, but they were in the process of being.
And was the prosecutor the same in all these cases, or don't you know?
I don't know for a fact. I'm speculating that probably not, because I know that ADA O'Rourke received this file relatively close in time to the trial date, within a month or so before it was transferred from someone else.
But did the file show that there were other defendants in the involved?
Yes, I believe it would have shown that, and just the record itself showed that there were other individuals.
Right, so one assumes that the prosecutor would say, oh, we must have those files, I better look at them and see what's in there, because there may be something on the defendant I'm dealing with, right?
Right, yes.
The prosecutor didn't do that within a month.
Apparently not, and yes, I would agree with you that in a perfect world, yes, he should have examined all the files related to this case and found that particular
None
document.
None of us lives in a well, I shouldn't speak for the rest of the court or for any of you. I don't live in a perfect world. And at oral argument, if I don't have everything at my fingertips, I have time to get it. Because I'm not going to have to write a decision or edit a decision or correct a decision for several days or weeks, right? In trial, you're up against a deadline, and you don't get a second chance. And the DA's offices are short of staff. The audit found something like over 100 assistant DAs are needed across the state, and I don't think the legislature provided bit of those, in fact, very few. So I'm very sympathetic of a staff that has a lot of cases and limited time. But it's hard to defend that the file wasn't opened until maybe the night before.
That's probably true, Your Honor. And the Court of Appeals, in their opinion, recognized that and came down pretty strongly on the prosecutor's office, saying, you know, in the correct situation in the proper case, this was prejudicial to the defendant, this could be a problem. This could be a situation that would warrant a mistrial.
Okay, so you don't take objection to the Court of Appeals chastising?
No, Your Honor. I think that was proper. I think that, you know, it was a good message
fair.
To send and fair. Yes, I do.
Okay, let's talk about the strength of your evidence, because we have to get to that. So we got a few problems, whether you want to call them errors or human frailties, it's not a perfect trial, right? And that's why none of them are, and the ones that have what appear to be serious imperfections come here, but they don't always require reversal, right? So how strong is your case?
Your Honor, I would obviously dispute what appellant's counsel has asserted that it was a weak case.
On a 1 to 10, 10 being the strongest, where is this?
I would say it's between a 7 and an 8.
Okay.
Based on the strength of this circumstantial evidence.
Okay, what
yes,
was
it was it? Circumstantial. No one saw him wearing the jacket that had the drugs in the pocket.
Right.
But the fact that, and this is one thing that was not mentioned by opposing counsel, that his size of Mr. Harris in comparison, which is all in the record, in the trial record, comparison to every other occupant of that house was a stark contrast. He was probably a good 100 pounds heavier than everyone else in that house and 6 inches taller.
So this looks like his jacket and his pants. Okay.
Based on his size, the XXL sizing on both the jacket and the pants, which had the same fabric and the same brand name, green denim Guess, apparently, jacket and pants. The fact that the pants were located directly next to him on the couch where he was sleeping in his boxer shorts. The fact that he selected those pants without anyone suggesting that he put them on, without any encouragement from any of the officers present. He selected to put them on. The fact there was his Illinois identification in the pocket, that's in the record, and also along with $615 in cash in the pocket of the pants. The jacket was found hanging over a closet doorway in the room directly adjacent to the room he was sleeping on the couch in, and
where was the cash?
The $615 in cash was in the pants pocket, okay, along with his Illinois identification. In the pocket of the matching jacket, which was hanging in the bedroom, was the baggie with $615,
the inference is you're selling drugs. Is that the point of the cash?
That was the argument, the point of introducing that evidence, and yes, that $615 is an unusually large amount of cash to have in your pocket, and that it's consistent with the practice of drug dealers to have cash in order to transact, make change or what have you, that in the experience of the testifying officers,
that was... So it's cash, the drugs in the jacket?
Cash and identification in the pants, drugs in the jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the link between the jacket and the pants mm-hmm. is important. The evidence that is in the record that established that was the proximity of the pants to Mr. Harris, the fact he put them on out of his own volition without any encouragement from anyone there. That was testified to by several of the officers present. It was also in the complaint and information. And the jacket being the same size, which fit him, same size also as a couple T-shirts that were found in a duffel bag, which was directly below the jacket, which he admitted was his duffel bag.
I'm going to accept, if I were on the jury, that those were his pants and his jacket, and he had $615 and the drugs. Okay, what else have he got?
I was starting to talk about the duffel bag, which was located directly underneath the jacket in the bedroom. Apparently a closet door was open, the jacket was hanging over the closet door, then the duffel bag. He admitted, he said, yes, that is my duffel bag.
Okay, but that puts him in this jacket and in these pants, right? I'm going to accept that.
Yes.
And in the jacket and pants is $615 in drugs, right?
Both. Combined. The jacket and the pants, yes.
Let me just interrupt briefly. Wasn't there also identification in the pants, identification?
Yeah. I'm accepting, as mm-hmm. the juror, I'm accepting that these are his pants and his jacket. Mm-hmm. And in the pants and jacket, there's $615 in drugs. What else have you got?
We have the duffel bag, which had the matching T-shirts, and also two identifying documents.
Right.
With his name on it.
His jacket and his pants.
Yep.
Got it.
And he is asleep in the house. He's known to be present there on a regular basis, not just an overnight visitor.
His friends aren't of the... His friends are drug dealers or users.
Apparently so, yes.
Okay. So we got 615 drugs, and his friends are drug dealers.
Mm-hmm. And the other individuals located in the house at the time did not have the proximity to the drugs that he had. Everyone else was in separate bedrooms. One couple was down, located on a completely different floor, down in the basement. Another was in a back bedroom or something. I mean, it was pretty far away from where he was located, very close, you know, right next to these pants and very close to the jacket with the drugs and the duffel bag with his name on two documents.
What was the penalty?
What was he sentenced to, Your Honor? I believe it was 5 years.
In prison?
I think 3 in and 2 extended mm-hmm. supervision. Is that wrong? That's my memory.
Might have been a bit more. I think it was 5 initial confinement and 5 extended supervision.
Was it 5 and 5? Yeah. Okay, Your Honor, I'll accept that.
Do you recall the facts of the DeLau case?
Yes, Your Honor. I've recently reread the DeLau case. And would you like me to explain my understanding of it, or Justice Bradley?
Justice Prosser might know. Also. Yeah.
How would you compare the discovery indiscretion of the prosecution in the two cases, this one and that one?
DeLau differs from this case quite dramatically. In that, in DeLau, the statements made by the defendant in that case, which were made during an interview, I believe, or some sort of interrogation or interview of her, and notes were taken of them, and the statements at issue went directly to her fear of this other party who was also separately prosecuted, I believe. So that interview was done as a part of that separate prosecution. But was a piece of evidence that was in a file that directly went to what was known to be her defense, which was that she was afraid of this individual. And I think what the statements were was that she was not afraid or something like that. So just to get that straightened out. So that would go directly to impeach her. That document was not turned over. She had already made a decision to testify and then was informed sometime during trial that this document existed and therefore had to suddenly make a decision, well, do I then decline to testify knowing I'm going to be impeached when I've already said I'm going to be testifying, or do I go ahead and and because the court said that this was that this would come in, that they wouldn't, that the trial court wouldn't exclude it.
Well, just follow up. My recollection is that the files in this case are the prosecutor's files. They're all the prosecutor's files. The files in the other case were not the prosecutor's files. The prosecutor didn't know about these statements.
Lau, you mean? And
yeah.
The prosecutor didn't know? I think subjectively he didn't know, but I think there was a finding that objectively he should have known because, you know, the knowledge of the police officers were attributable to the prosecutor. And, you know, we can see some similarities on the surface between a document being misfiled or not being included in both files in this case. And, yes, it should have, the fingerprint document should have been turned over. But
prosecutor,
I think,
objectively, yes, know what's in his own files?
I think that's true. So I think in that case, in that way, there is a similarity that yes, in this case, ADA O'Rourke should have known what was in the other file and did. I mean, he didn't think of it, unfortunately, until noonish that day, but, you know, or in the morning, and then he did retrieve it. But, you know, he did objectively and subjectively both, really, know that this document existed. He went and got it, you know, and then turned it over immediately. There was still the opportunity for defense counsel to cross-examine Investigator Patton on the document. You know, he chose basically to let that come in. The trial court did make a ruling that it couldn't come in on the state's direct the direct case. So, you know, I think in this case it was different. There was a sanction imposed on the state. The defense counsel really made a choice to pursue that line anyway, and really it was a neutral piece of evidence in so many ways because it was showing there was no fingerprints that could be lifted, not that there was someone else's fingerprints or not something that, you know, impeached the defendant didn't even testify in this case, you know, but that would have gone directly to impeach a defense that the defendant was trying to assert, like in DeLau. So it's very different in the sense that, you know, even if it's the same in that he should have known it was there and should have turned it over ahead of time, he did think of it, he did turn it over, you know, did the best he could, and then by the time, you know, it came in, there was that ability of the defense counsel to readjust, to do the best he could to work with the evidence that was in front of the court. And that's another reason why this case differs from the other case cited by the Del Rio case, is it did come in.
So before you go to Del Rio, what about the summary of the oral statement that he made, which is clearly and was argued inculpatory? You know, would you hand me my pants? And the pants are a direct link. And then when I went back and looked at the complaint, as you argued, what was in the complaint, the complaint indicates that he put on. It doesn't say voluntarily. It doesn't say he reached. It just says he put on those pants. But here you've got a statement that, hand me my pants, and if the link to the crime is in the pants, that's clearly an inculpatory statement. So doesn't this put this in the same area as the Glau case in terms of potential impeachment evidence that could be used against the defendant should the defendant testify?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor, and this is why. In this case, well, first of all, the statement that he made that's in the record was Officer Bloderon testified, those are the pants he asked to put on. There was nothing about those are my pants or really any ownership statement. It's still kind of a stretch, in my opinion, to say if he asked to put on pants when he's sitting there in his boxer shorts, that necessarily means they're his pants. And there was so much other evidence they were his pants. His ID was in the pocket. They fit him. They were right next to him, et cetera, et cetera.
And but the statement, this is the pants that he has to put on.
Mm-hmm.
How many times are you going to ask to put on somebody else's pants?
It's true. I mean, logically speaking. But my point is he didn't say, those are my pants. Give them to me.
Okay.
So there is a little bit of a difference. But beyond that, in DeLau, get those names mixed up, there was this interview of the defendant and a written document created, a report or what have you, describing what her statements were that was not turned over. In this case, Officer Bloderon testified from his memory and perception, essentially, that, oh, those are the ones he asked to put on. None of the other officers that were present testified that he asked They all, you know, stated, no one told him to, he did it on his own, but no one else said that he asked. There was a couple other officers there. Detective Rossler was there, and I believe Investigator Patton was in the vicinity, too, at the time. So my argument is that he was really incapable of disclosing it. There wasn't a document he could disclose that described this statement. It wasn't just that he objectively should have known that this statement existed in Officer Blodorn's mind. It was something that Officer Blodorn testified to at trial that he didn't know about ahead of time, and he even testified at the post-conviction proceeding, ADA O'Rourke, that he was surprised when Officer Blodorn said that.
Well, the reason I asked the question is because, as I hear your argument, and that's what concerns me about your argument, it's one thing to sit there and argue that, look, he didn't turn over the statement, but how much of a big deal is this? I mean, he's, you know, he's put on the pants. You know, maybe we should have turned over a summary, but it really doesn't have an impact on this trial. It's another thing to say that the prosecutor doesn't have an obligation to investigate his or her own case to find out whether there are statements that are available so that the prosecutor can comply with 971-23-1B and provide a written summary of all oral statements of the defendant which the district attorney plans to use in the course of trial and the names of the witnesses to the defendant's oral statements. Because if we're saying, well, he didn't know what the answer was, well, then that means there's really no duty for the prosecutor to investigate.
Your Honor, I agree. And I'm not arguing that he didn't have an obligation to investigate his case by any means. What happened here was that the testimony of Officer Blodorn that he asked to put on the pants objectively was not something he could have known about because that was a perception of Officer Blodorn that wasn't written down anywhere, that wasn't something, I mean, even if you would have asked him ahead of time, what are you going to say, he wouldn't necessarily have said that he asked to put on the pants. I think that was, it really was something that was in his mind and his perception of the event as he was testifying to it at that moment. And beyond that, even, the fact that he made that statement that he asked to put on the pants just doesn't put this over the edge as being, you know, that this was the one piece of evidence that linked him to the pants. There were so many other pieces of evidence that linked him to the pants that it just doesn't rise to the level of prejudice.
Counsel, the analytical framework for me is, number one, is there a violation? If so, is there good cause for it? And if not, was it prejudicial? So boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I know that you're arguing that there's no prejudice, yet a strong case. What do you see as the violations or the errors here, even though there may have been good cause and they may not have been prejudicial? What were the errors?
I would say, and again, errors, I'm not sure if I like that term, but mistakes or, you know, inadvertent.
No, I'm talking about errors.
Okay.
Here. How about, what's
violations of 971.23?
Well, how about 90609 sub 1, 90609, impeachment by evidence of conviction or adjudication of delinquency? Do you acknowledge there was an error with regard to that?
Yes, Your Honor. We haven't gotten to that issue in my portion of the argument here, but yes, and I believe that was acknowledged at trial. You know, we all goofed up on this, but yes, it's and the analysis continues that it's harmless error because of the bulk of the evidence.
And you earlier made reference to the Court of Appeals decision where they said, and you got it just right, paragraph 12, they said, this is regarding the fingerprint issue. Mm-hmm. Such conduct could be deemed prejudicial failure to disclose in the appropriate case. And you said, you know, you agreed with that admonition. Mm-hmm. That's the very last sentence of the paragraph. In the earlier part, they take him to task for not doing it, for not handing it over in the way that it was done. What saved them in paragraph 12, according to the Court of Appeals, is it wasn't prejudicial, mm-hmm. which presupposes it was error. It just wasn't prejudicial. I mean, do you think that there was error with regard to the fingerprint, even though there may have been good cause and it wasn't prejudicial?
I think that you could characterize it as error, that this was in a co-defendant's file and should have been turned over, and if ADA O'Rourke had more time to prepare, been able to go through every single file on his desk, and, obviously he had it in the back of his mind because he had seen it previously.
Sure,
should have thought of it.
But that's what the Court of Appeals said. So yes. Now I've come up with two. It's your turn.
Is there any other error? I don't think there are anymore. Certainly the testimony about the criminal bond.
I did that
and,
already.
Right.
Yeah. 906.
Although it
that
didn't
was
reveal
there.
What kind of crime it was, but yes,
you
I mean we all agree that,
that
he shouldn't have asked the open-ended question, and he agreed that too, that it's harmless error. I cannot see any error in the oral statement issue because of the fact, as I was explaining before, that this was not really discoverable in the way. I mean,
it wasn't in his possession.
It wasn't anything in his possession that could have been found in a file that was misfiled.
So the difference between you and defense counsel is he sees three errors, you see two.
That would be fair. Yes, I would say, as far as the fingerprint issue, because you get to the. Really, the crux of my argument is you get to the third stage of the analysis that there was absolutely no prejudice because of the fact that it was neutral evidence and it didn't affect the verdict, affect the result.
Then the question is not, does 0 plus 0 plus 0 equals 0? It is, does 1/3 plus 1/3? No, I'm just teasing.
Yeah, no, I understand, and I remember that
now,
part of my brief.
Was there any good cause here?
I'm sorry, I just noticed my light.
Was there a good cause?
Good cause for the violations.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I believe, as my opposing counsel stated, there didn't seem to be a lot of case law on good cause for a violation. I don't know if good cause kind of meshes into no prejudice, but I think it could. The fact that, this was not a intentional non-disclosure, prosecutorial misconduct, anything like that. It was inadvertent. I know that good faith doesn't necessarily equal good cause, but, in this case, there was no prejudice that resulted from it. And as I said before, I think everyone did the best that they could on both sides of the fence. And, where we started out, trials are not perfect, and there was perhaps a couple things that went wrong in this one. It's not the case to apply a cumulative effect argument because of the nature of the mistakes and the fact that there was so much circumstantial evidence against Mr. Harris that the outcome was just not affected by anything that happened during the trial that was not in his favor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Defense counsel.
Thank you. During the ensuing 30 minutes, I looked through the file a little bit, and I unfortunately we're going to reference a few pages that are not in my appendix, if I may. It's Detective Corey Ressler's testimony. It begins on page 167, ends about page 187 of the trial transcript. And it does say that the ID card and the wallet of Mr. Harris was actually found in the kitchen, I believe, and taking a quick look at what was there. The bail bond was found in the northeast bedroom, which I didn't really look at the detail to see if that's the exact bedroom where Mr. Harris is found sleeping, but I think that is an important point to discuss on a scale of 1 to 10, how strong was the evidence in this case. I guess I'd place it around a 3, to be honest, and I say that with, if we had 10 separate trials, how many would lead to conviction, how many would lead to acquittal, and in my opinion, maybe 3 would have led to conviction. I don't know if that's worth anything from an opinion standpoint or a written decision, but I think that's my view of how this case should have gone. Also, Attorney Gary does try to question how baggy the pants were, and certain younger people these days wear baggy pants and that type of thing, so I don't think the size was really much of an issue. I guess I took a little extra time in my earlier 25 minutes, and I would just like to close by, again, pointing out the language in DeLeo, however you pronounce it, and it's paragraph 65, that the state's discovery violation undermined the essence of discovery, and I just love that phrase, the essence of the discovery, which is explained as a person having the opportunity to choose a strategy and prepare for trial in light of all the evidence that should have been provided to the defendant. And in this case, all the evidence was not provided to the defendant, and it did disrupt the strategy. if nothing else, certainly caused Mr. Geary's blood pressure to go up and to have him think probably less clearly than he should have because of this violation. Certainly trials are very tense and trying times for people, and I think that in this particular instance, the discovery violation disrupted him, but it also disrupted the entire strategy that he had put forward, as is made clear by the gaffe, if you will, in the opening statement that came out. It did indeed put Mr. Harris and Mr. Geary in the horns of a dilemma that he could not be easily extracted from. And I think that throughout the case law, and even since Brady versus Maryland, which I'll go back to the Packer theme, which is BBF, that's before Brett Favre, that we are getting to that point that we should have justice where people know what's essentially going to come out. We don't have an open records policy in the statutes. In practice, it is being used. But I think when Tim Geary walked into the courtroom that day, or at least was in front of the courthouse 10 minutes before the trial was about to start, he had one impression, and that was quickly changed as a result of the discovery violations.
Counsel, can yes? I just ask, in his closings, I've seen some incredible lawyering, and, you know, I've rarely seen a trial go without some snafus along the way. You'd have to admit that.
Well, especially when I'm involved.
And, with respect to closing, I could see a group of facts under which defense counsel could say, you know, I walked in here and I thought this case was about this, and then for the first time today, we learned this, this, and this. Isn't it interesting how law enforcement did this or didn't reveal this, or we learned this today? And they turn the case to be one of law enforcement's mess up instead of theirs. And that's not an uncommon way to approach these kinds of things. Did counsel do that in this case?
I didn't see that happen. To be quite honest, I don't think that's very effective. I think that the jurors, especially in that part of the state, they basically want to believe their government officials. They want to believe law enforcement. They are naturally going to believe what law enforcement has to say. I mean, nobody wins an election by saying, I'm going to go easy on crime. I mean, people want to believe that the criminal justice system is fair. And to kind of hit them between the eyes and say, well, gee, this is unfair. Look at all this stuff that occurred. We have this statute, 971.23, in Brady versus Maryland, I think, the jury's eyes are going to glaze over. They don't care.
Counsel, maybe I'm confused. I thought Mr. Geary actually asked for that type of an instruction.
He did ask for the instruction.
Now.
Correct. If that instruction had been there and had been linked up with his argument, that maybe he would have gone that way. But I don't think in and of itself, in a solitary way, that that's a very effective argument. I got to admit, and Mr. Geary's argument was not as strong as it could have been if his assumptions had been true, that there had been no fingerprinting. You know, I can see him standing there saying, if they thought this guy was so guilty, why didn't they even try to get the fingerprints off this baggie? I mean, he could have done that. That would have been very effective, in my opinion, and he was not allowed to do that. Okay. Thank you.
Was there anything in the trial court record about plea negotiation?
A plea negotiation? I didn't see anything in the trial court record about that.
All right.
Thank you.
That concludes our discussion today of discovery under criminal statutes. Since our hearing on 06-AP-882-CR, State versus Harris, and I want to thank both counsel for doing an excellent job today. We are adjourned for oral argument in January. The court will meet in the conference room at 10 after 3.